Well, good evening, everyone. What a treat.
Just a week in the Bay Area.
A week. Well, it's a small treat.
It's too short, but it's good to be here.
It's wonderful to see you, Dan.
It's good to be back. I wouldn't come back without coming back.
I miss you.
Mm-hmm. I miss you, too.
Yeah.
I listened to you in China.
Oh. Well.
All the audio's on
that's
the
right.
website.
That's right.
So thank you.
Oh. So glad. And we have a new face tonight. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
How did you find us?
Anne Kugio-Raiso. I met her at Hakkaian Japanese Gardens Meditation many years ago, and she also meditates at Middleway Zendo in downtown San Jose. So she mentioned this location. I found the website.
Nice. Lovely. I'll give her my best.
I will. Thank you for letting me meditate with you.
Absolutely. Our door is open. Let's make introductions around.
Ellie.
I'm Dan.
I'm Doug.
Sylvia.
Jeffrey.
Judy.
Great.
So we are studying Uchiyama Roshi's. We've done this before, right? Yeah.
Listen to it in China.
That's amazing.
That's
yeah, there's an artist in France who listens to it too. He writes every now and then.
Well, he sent you artwork.
He sent a beautiful piece of artwork that hangs in my office now. Huge. Gorgeous. And I have some Chinese things from you already. Mm-hmm. Yeah, beautiful. So we've gotten to question... where are we?
11.
11, which looks like a tiny, tiny little question with a very tiny answer. But if you look in the back of the book, Uchiyama Roshi extenuates it very, very long and plunges into the Bodhisattva precepts, which is a very important aspect of our practice. And he gives all of them in this account, which is kind of wonderful. There are many different translations. There's a whole fat book of translations of the precepts, the whole 16 of them, and then the whole of the Bodhidharma precepts as well. So everybody has his own or her own version of it, but basically it's the same. So the question is it necessary for those who focus on the zazen to strictly observe the precepts? So going on the questions that they've asked so far, and Dogen's saying, well, zazen is the only thing, and you don't have to do anything else, no incense, no chanting, no nothing, just sit. And then they say, well, how about the precepts? Oh, Dogen says, that's different. That's really, really different. He says, the sacred practice of maintaining the precepts is indeed the guiding rule of the Zen gate and the traditional style of Buddhas and ancestors. But even those who have not yet received precepts or who have broken the precepts still do not lack the possibility to practice zazen. You can be a really, really bad girl, and you can still practice precepts, and you can still sit. It's okay. That's heartening. sometimes people say, oh, my mind is so screwed up and I'm so messed up and I can't sit. But that's the best time to sit. Truly, it's the best time. So Uchiyama Roshi takes this very much to heart. He says precepts is kai, K-A-I, and our precept ceremony, the first precept ceremony that we do is jukai, receiving the precepts. It's the first time, but not the last time. Actually, the last time, if you are in this practice tradition, is when you die. And if you haven't taken the precepts with jukai, you are given the precepts in your coffin to be sent off to wherever. But it's very clear that that is a part of the necessary practice. He makes a distinction between precepts and regulations that I don't think are accurate in my understanding. I don't like to argue with Uchiyama Roshi, but I will tell you that he says precepts are for refraining from doing evil things. But it's really, Hoban's teaching was that the precepts are to expose our mind, our life and body as we live in the moment to what we're doing to keep us awake. So if we vow not to kill, we can't keep that precept and be perfect and not ever kill anything, because even if you wipe your eyebrows, you're killing myriad people, much less walking across the sidewalk, much less eating a carrot. Whatever we do, we are creating disaster wherever we go. I'm reading about a Native American practices where they apologize and ask permission for the killing that they do. And they say that if they're actually killing an animal, that they wait until the animal gives them permission, that the deer will stop and look and present itself. So none of the precepts are about perfecting ourselves. It's the opposite. It's about just having a guideline to keep us aligned, you could say, aligned with our own best intentions, our own best direction. And we screw up all the time. All the time. And the last one is no abusing the three treasures. And that's us. And so that's very important too, that we don't beat ourselves up because we can't be perfect with the precepts. It's not like that. So the precepts arrived in Buddha's life. We get them from all the way back then. As they practiced together, the monks and the nuns came together over and over to hear Buddha speak. And sometimes they came to Buddha and said, you know, Joe over there just took my razor. And we should do something about that. People shouldn't take things from each other like that. And Buddha said, well, let's let's make an understanding together that we won't take anything that isn't given to us. And so that's one of the precepts, not to take what is not given. Otherwise known as stealing, no stealing. And little by little, a very long list of some of them very strange, and from a very ancient and weird culture in our view. If you've read them, they're quite amazing. But the basic ones have lived all the way through to now in Zen. The whole list is existing in Theravadin for the Theravadin monks and nuns, so that they can't touch money, they can't receive anything from anybody, they can only eat one meal a day. It's very, very strict. I spent a little while at Abhayagiri with some of the monks up there, and they kind of bend the rules a little bit. A monk isn't supposed to sit next to a woman, but the monk wanted to drive me around the property and show me everything, where the little kutis were and everything. So he said, "Oh, it's all right, you can sit next to me. Don't tell anybody." And they do have sweets and tea at the end of the day. So even though they're not supposed to be eating, they love candy and all kinds of yummy stuff, and they pour sugar in their tea to get them through until the next meal at noon the next day. The Mahayana took another direction, not so strict, and took a more kindly view of life, even for monks and nuns. Life isn't so quite so difficult. So Uchiyama Roshi says the fundamental spirit of the precepts in Chinese and Japanese Zen originated with Bodhidharma's one mind precepts. He took those 248 precepts for men and 380 something, I think, for women. That, of course, is a problem in the West also. Women get very huffy about that. In the beginning of comments on one mind precepts, it says, "To receive the precepts is to transmit the precepts. To transmit the precepts is to awaken to the Buddha mind. Therefore, to receive the precepts in their true sense is to realize Buddha mind." Uchiyama says, "This is the most essential point. Observing precepts is not simply a matter of social morality, nor something we should do or shouldn't do." And then he gives us all of them. And I will give them to you. Self-nature is wonderful and imperceptible. Within the everlasting Dharma, not arousing the view of extinction is called the precept of not killing. Not arousing the view. He says, self-nature is what I call reality of life. And since the reality of life cannot be grasped by words, it is said to be wondrous and imperceptible. Says everything is the reality of life. It can't be killed by anything. When I first took the precepts, and this was very much on my mind, we went to visit a mountain in up at Tamales Bay that had burned. It was a whole forest and very high mountain back behind Inverness, and it burned badly. And it was such a tragedy. It was just awful for that whole neighborhood and for everybody who loved Point Reyes. And we went back there just to see and took a walk. And it was black. Everything was black, and these skeletons of trees were everywhere. It was just tragic. Except if you looked at the ground and there were little bits of green everywhere. It was all coming back, all by itself. Just like that. And I thought, oh, that's what Bodhidharma means. It always comes back. Even if the earth disappears. That's weird. That's really weird. The second one is self-nature is wondrous and imperceptible within the ungraspable Dharma, not arousing the thought of gaining. It's called the precept of not stealing. That's one that our whole culture is in great need of. The whole life of us is about wanting more, wanting to get things, and even more things, and it's never, never enough. And it's true that we can't own anything. So the real truth of this precept is that there is nobody owns anything. We all have some things to which we have a lot of responsibility, but they're not really ours. They're just on loan, as maybe as long as we're around, or maybe for a day, or for the life of our car, but then it turns into something else. Turns into junk, turns into a used car that a teenager is driving. It could be anything, but none of it is ours. The third one is self-nature wondrous and imperceptible in the Dharma, which is free from attachment. The Dharma which is free from attachment, not arousing a desire to attach oneself to anything, is called the precept of not having sexual desire. So it isn't that the sexual desire is a bad thing. It's the attachment that goes along with it that creates havoc often. And lots of Hollywood movies. It's one of the things that drives us, and one of the things that it's very hard to understand, especially when you're young. But also, again, we don't own our partners. We don't own anyone we love. And it's one of the poignant sorrows of our life that if we love someone, we're bound to lose each other. One of us is going to die before the other. And that's built into our love. And so it's very important to be very clear about that, and understand our attachment and accept it as the poignant side of our life, which makes it so sweet and so wonderful. If we lived forever, it might be a whole different feeling. Self-nature is wondrous and imperceptible within the inexplicable Dharma, the inexplicable Dharma. Not speaking a single word is called the precept of not speaking falsehood. whatever we say is a lie. Whatever we try to say to express the truth can't get there. It's beyond us. Writers have a terrible time, and Cézanne, for one, lived a life of total frustration because he said he never got what he had in his mind on the canvas, even though he made exquisite paintings. We can't reach it with our clumsy bodies. What comes out of us is, can point to it. And that's the way we use words, if we're wise, is to point to the truth, because it can't be said. Self-nature is wondrous and imperceptible within the intrinsically pure Dharma, intrinsically pure. Not being blinded by ignorance is called the precept of not drinking intoxicating liquor. That's one translation. It's kind of a funny one. It's about not clouding the mind. That's how we say it. The precept of not clouding the mind, meaning with lies, with garbage, with drugs, with anything that distorts inherent wisdom and twists the way our mind works and causes confusion. In the midst of confusion, it's very hard to live without wounding ourselves and others. And we know that. We know that in our culture, what a terrible thing this precept brings up, and how hard it is to deal with the little towns in the Midwest that are overwhelmed by drugs, OxyContin. It's unbelievable. Stoned, a whole little town stoned. Self-nature is wondrous and imperceptible within the flawless Dharma. Not speaking of others' faults is called the precept of not speaking of the faults of the four kinds of the Sangha. No speaking of others' mistakes. No judgment. Once judgment kicks in, then there's me and you. And either you're better than I am, or I'm better than you are, or it doesn't work. It gets very crunchy. Self-nature is wondrous and imperceptible within the non-discriminating Dharma. Not distinguishing oneself from others is called the precept of not praising oneself or slandering others. That's very clear. They're sort of the same, those two. Self-nature is wondrous and imperceptible within the Dharma, which is the all-pervading true reality. Not arousing greed is called the precept of not begrudging Dharma or material. We say no hoarding materials or teachings. No keeping it all to myself. Don't even ask about it. I won't tell you. Self-nature is wondrous and imperceptible within the ego-less Dharma. not substantializing the ego is called the precept of not being angry. The way Coben translated that was not positing a self and an other, something like that. As soon as you say me and you as two separate beings, then you have the condition of separation. And one way to try to close that sense of separation is anger. We feel it as something that's wrong, and one way is to reach out and in a fierce way and try to get them to change their mind in some way. It's like that boy who killed his girlfriend yesterday, who just didn't want her to leave him. And he said, I just wanted her to stay with me. And boom. I mean, it's built into us, this violence, I think. And yet, it's also built into us this great wisdom that we have to know ourselves when it happens. And if we're lucky, we can become enough, have enough self-knowledge that it doesn't drive our life. That we realize that there, whatever we confront is another version of us. There isn't any me or you and you, ultimately. Every day there is. There's Mary and Joe and Phil, and there's the Pope and the Dalai Lama and all these very different characters. We're all characters in a story in a way. But we're all in the same soup and we all belong. So it's a lie when we develop that sense of separation. Uchiyama Roshi says, since everything is the reality of life, there is no I. He says, there is no ego which becomes angry. It's all made up, like a puppet show. And the last one is, self-nature is wondrous and imperceptible. Within the Dharma, which is the single reality, not arousing a dualistic view of sentient beings and Buddhas, is called the precept of not slandering the three treasures. The dualistic view of sentient beings and Buddhas. We're all in the same reality. And what Dogen always says is, sometimes Buddha, sometimes ordinary. Sometimes Buddha mind, sometimes ordinary mind. It's the view that's different. The reality is the same. He says, Bodhidharma's one-mind precepts are as above. The fundamental attitude of self-nature is wondrous and imperceptible is most important here. That is, we must see the life of the self thoroughly and settle on the ground of the reality of life. This is Zazen, and Zazen is the foundation for all precepts. So, are there questions? Dave?
Did Buddha have a sense of humor?
I wonder about that sometimes. It doesn't show up very much in the sutras. He was very responsive to people, extremely alert to what's going on, and willing to step up and even expose himself to danger in order to meet people. But there aren't any funny stories, except when he maybe, and it's probably apocryphal, but it's one of my favorites, when he was in his little kuti, when he was fairly old by then, and Ananda was at the door, and Mara came and wanted in. He wanted to see Buddha, and Ananda said, "No way, you know, go away, Mara. You know, you're not welcome here." And Buddha said, "Ananda, who's at the door?" And he said, "Oh, it's just Mara. I'm sending him away." And Buddha said, "Oh, why don't you have him in for tea?" And so Mara came in for tea. I think that's very heartening. That our Maras can actually, we can entertain them and not be frightened by them, but have them in and give them a little something to keep them happy. That's a fun question. That's a fun question.
Is Mara another person, or is it the monkey side of who we are?
It's the latter, yeah.
Okay, so it's not the guy that cut me off the freeway that pissed me off. Right?
No, it's your mind.
Right.
The mind you have when he cuts you off. Depending on the mind you have when he cuts you off.
So don't be pissed at it, just have a little tea with it, have it be a gentle transition rather than being pissed at oneself.
Yes.
Or being pissed.
Yes, exactly. Mara was what the thing that came to tempt Buddha. When he was under the tree, many times he brought dancing girls and he brought beautiful food and he brought, just as Jesus was tempted by the devil, he was offering him incredible wealth and power over the whole world. And over Buddha declined. So it's that aspect of us, the egotistical as the great me, that gets in the way of practice.
So there's the decline and there's the having them over for tea.
Yes.
So there's two different things going on.
Well, once you decline and once you conquer that,
then
you can do the tea. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You build enough strength so you're not being crushed by it.
Exactly. Yes. It's really sort of the point of our practice in a way. It's our effort. Dan?
I'm paraphrasing. You said, I think, and I want to make sure I understood what you said before I asked my question. You said we usually see ourself in other. Is that basically what you said? That we our
no.
only way to understand our view is to see ourself in what we think is something other than us. Is that what you said?
That if we understand and can see the other as another aspect of ourself, that then we are living what he calls, Uchiyama calls, the reality of life. otherwise we're living as if we're all different and we're all separate and one is better than the other, all of that. If we can meet each other as, you could say, brothers and sisters, kin, then it's a whole different kind of view and a whole different way to live. So there's not that sense of separation.
I see. So seeing actually the self, big S self, in other, capital O, I guess.
Yes, you could say that.
Is the right view.
Yes.
Now, what's ironic about this is my question was going to be about the small self, the me, the egocentric small S self.
Yes.
If you see the small S self everywhere, that is presumably like selfishness on a grander scale. You know, you see,
oh, it could be.
You know, you see the guy on the highway cutting you off. The highway is designed for you to get from here to there, and he's interfering with your travel.
That's right.
So the small self S sees this guy cutting off you, small y, on your road. You know, not
yes.
the road.
Yes.
Your road.
Yes.
So if we turn that around and see that is not an individual I, but the grander I, the grander ego, in the big sense, big mind sense,
mm-hmm.
then that is what Uchiyama Roshi and you were talking about, that it's the more inclusive way of practice.
It is. It's a very inclusive way of practice. We can, if we like, consider everything that we meet as Buddha. Suzuki Roshi at one point said, pointed around and said, Buddha, 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 Buddha.
Wow.
So, and I mean, it would be a little extra. I mean, we can't go floating around and bowing to everybody, but we can appreciate everything for that, including the trees and the grass. And the wild cats, the feral cats, and the everything. Actually, it's all connected. It's all of a piece. Dave?
Is there? I mean, I've often heard of sensual desire as a hindrance to meditation and a violation, not a violation, but a neglect of the precept, of that precept. But I was wondering, is there any such thing as healthy sensuality, like between a husband and a wife or something like
Absolutely.
That?
Absolutely.
I see.
If you take a vow, then that's one thing. But if you haven't taken a vow of, it's not celibacy. Celibacy is the wrong word. Anyway, not having sex anymore. That's one thing. But that there's no rule about that for. Even for monks get married, priests get married in Zen and have children, and their children have children, and it all goes on. So, yeah. But it's also that precept about attachment is very much a part of it, that it's not seen as some kind of big Hollywood drama of...
Remember in the Theravada, in the Dhammapada, it said something about the bond between men and women is
yes.
one of the strongest and hardest to overcome, or something like that.
Well, Shantideva was The monks were monks, yeah. And they were talking to monks.
Yeah.
They weren't talking to us.
Okay.
And one of the beauties of this book is that Dogen was talking to us, especially.
Mm-hmm.
And as we go on, there are a couple more things about practice that are especially for lay people, which is very encouraging, I think. I'm always so glad to do Bendoa. But it's after 8 o'clock. I'm sorry. We're a little late tonight. We do our 1-minute sit.